Hi, everybody. I'm Maureen, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you so much for having me here today. Billy, thank you for asking me to come and speak. It's always really an honor to get asked to speak, especially for somebody like me. My sobriety date is August 14th, 1988. My home group is the Paramount Group. In Paramount, California, if you're ever in LA by chance, make sure that, you know, we know about it because we'll come and take care of you. I'm sponsored and I sponsor people and I'm in the middle of AA. All that stuff wasn't so true when I first got sober. I was a physically addicted alcoholic when I got to AA. If you didn't drink long enough to have that happen and you were here because you were on a court card or you had some bad stuff happen or your health went south or there was a reason for quitting, that's just as valid. But for me, like by the time I got here, I was physically addicted. I would break out in DTs at odd times if I wasn't pretty much medicating myself 24/7. And by medicating myself, I mean using my drug of choice, alcohol. I've done every drug in the book at one point or another because I was a drinker. And when I was drunk, you could pretty much put anything underneath me and I would do it. But of all of them, alcohol was my thing. I started drinking when I was 15 years old. You know, I don't like to talk a lot about my childhood because I don't hold it responsible for my alcoholism. My mother was an alcoholic. I do know that this is genetic and that the statistic is that I had a 50% chance of being an alcoholic when I first picked up a drink. And I did not know that at the time. I just started drinking. You know, my tumultuous childhood, I've come to find out through sponsoring people that there's many people that had worse childhoods than mine, but I did have a tumultuous childhood, and when I was 15, I started drinking because I was socially awkward. I was a fish out of water everywhere I went, and it was the only time that I could calm myself down and feel a part of. You know, there's a speaker that says that, you know, he didn't drop out of reality by drinking, that drinking made him fit into reality. And that was my story too. I always felt like I was apart from, when I was 15, I was a politically active kid. Now my parents supported this. They drove me down to do my work every day when I was, you know, working in this campaign. And because I know the traditions, I'll tell you that I don't share about which side I was on, but what I will tell you is that everybody I ever worked for always lost. And the first time they lost was that first night when I was 15. And I remember that night like it was yesterday because there was a bottle of Boone's Farm apple wine on the table and I drank the whole thing. And, you know, I had been noodling with alcohol. Once I did that, I would noodle with it. I would steal my mom's alcohol. I would try to drink any chance I could that I thought I could get away with it. And eventually I didn't understand that I already had alcoholism. I'm not a person that it just grew into it. I had alcoholism from the gate. And basically what happened when I went home that night, they had to drive me home and they parked my dad's car in the garage. And I went in and there he was sitting there for the first of many times in his, slippers and his robe. And he goes, "You've been drinking, haven't you?" And I said, "No." The first of many alcoholic lies to come is if there's anybody new on this call tonight, if somebody asks you if you've been drinking, they already know the answer. There's no point in lying about it. They already know the answer. And that's what happened, you know. And he looked at me disgusted, you know, shook his head and said, go to bed. Tomorrow's another day. So I did that, and then I drank every chance I could get after that. And when I turned 18, I was a senior in high school. And by then, the ism had fully struck me. And I was doing things like writing myself out of school, because by then I was a legal adult. So I was writing my high school note saying, Maureen will not be attending school today. Signed, Maureen, and handing it in. And there was nothing they could do about it because I was a legal adult. And I did things like that. I just cut school a lot. Now, I'm a person who, for the whole first part of my childhood, I was getting straight A's in school. And I just decided one day that, you know, you just didn't fit in very well when you were like that. And I just stopped trying. And I don't know why that happened, but I just threw in the towel. Today, through doing some inventory work, what I suspect is that I was so afraid of what success was going to look like that I couldn't handle it. So I just decided because I couldn't be perfect, I didn't want to play. And when I dropped out because of that, that's what happened. And the day that I graduated from high school, there was some dissension about whether or not I was actually going to graduate because my parents had gotten a letter 2 weeks before my graduation saying that I was not going to graduate. And I did 2 years worth of work in about 2 weeks. And so I was going to get a diploma of some sort. And so basically, in the meantime, I had gotten accepted honors at entrance at Cal State Fullerton here in LA. And at the senior T, when they were giving out awards, this was mentioned, and everybody turned around and said, "What? Like, how in the world did that happen? How in the world did she get anything good to happen for her?" Well, so I knew that that's where I was sitting. So I got into Cal State Fullerton, and I was headed out there. But the last day I was at my high school, it was the day I graduated. I started drinking at about 9 o'clock in the morning, and I never stopped. I got so drunk that my uncle, who died like last year, he tried to cover my butt and drove me so that my parents wouldn't find out how drunk I was. And I ended up going to the high school graduation. The only thing was there was no covering my butt because I was so drunk that the next day I found out my math teacher stopped me and said, "Do you think you might be an alcoholic?" And of course I said, "No." I said, "No, every time everybody asked. If I had a dime for everybody that asked me that, I'd be a rich woman." And she said, "Well, the thing was you were standing on your chair at the graduation yesterday and you were singing the Star Spangled Banner, but the thing is you're not in the choir." So I literally was singing along with the choir from my seat, but I wasn't in the choir. Now, did I remember doing this? No, it was a blackout. So if there's anybody new on this call tonight, I'm going to tell you a little secret that I didn't find out until I got sober this last time after a lot of heartache. I found out that blackouts are a symptom of alcoholism. I didn't know that. I thought everybody blacked out when they drank too much. I didn't know that most people just stop drinking before they get to that point. But I came to find out that that is actually a symptom of alcoholism. So in any event, I started going to Cal State Fullerton, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. My dad would have paid for me to go to school anywhere I wanted to go, to do anything I wanted to do. So what do? I joined the art department. Now, that would have been great, except I can't paint or draw. So basically, I was being trained to do art, and I was terrible at it. And I made some friends that I still have to this day, but it was a terrible failure. And I did get some upper division credits that I'm going to use today. And there were some good things that came out of it, but I'll never forget my dad's face when several years in, I said, "I'm dropping out of college," after he just spent a boatload of cash on sending me there. And I had to make amends for it. And I told him before he died that I would not let him down and that I would make it up to him. And I did end up getting a college degree, and I'm still in school for a different college degree now, but I did make good on that promise, thanks to you people. And what happened was, you know, I did this for a while, and then I realized I just couldn't do it anymore. I just was dropping out of society a little bit at a time. And it was right around the time the punk rock scene was forming in Hollywood, in LA. Now, if you don't know what that is, it's angry people doing very high energy rock and roll and drinking a lot and doing a lot of drugs. And everybody I knew fell into that category. So I had finally found a bunch of people who drank like I did. And I spent the next several years there. And what happened is when I went up there to get a job after I dropped out of college, I remember I couldn't get a job because I didn't have any experience. And I went in one day and I said, hey, if you hire me, I'll work for, or if you want to try me out, I'll work for free for a week. And if you like my work, I'll stay. And if you don't, I'll move down the road. And they said, you really would do that? And I said, yeah. And they said, okay, well, you're hired then. And that's how I got a job in Hollywood. And I moved up there and they were training me to be a stockbroker, which was another thing that I didn't understand because do any of you want a drunk for a stockbroker? I didn't think I was going to be much good at that either, right? So I did that for 3 years. And at the end of it, I decided I wanted to be around the music business. And I quit that job and I went to work for a theatrical producer in Hollywood. And I worked there for several years after that. And the reason why this is pertinent to my alcoholism is because I was paid $500 a month. My rent in those days was $200, but I had all the alcohol I could drink. I could go see any show in Los Angeles for free. I could go backstage and drink the alcohol that was put out there for everybody else. And we basically spent those years in a consistent state of being drunk. And, you know, it wasn't pretty. And, you know, in the meantime, somewhere during that period, my mother got breast cancer. And my mother that I did not really have a great relationship with had breast cancer. And at the time, she showed me what late stage breast cancer looks like. And it wasn't pretty. And she said, you're going to go into denial just like me. I went into denial and now I'm going to die. And I want you to take a look at this because I don't want this to happen to you. And of course I said, okay, thank you. Cause I realized like it was an act of love, but I wanted to get away from her as quickly as I possibly could. So I excused myself and she proceeded to get worse after that because she was dying. And so I was still up in Hollywood and one day, you know, I would go down. We had such a painful relationship. I would go see her in the hospital. And then, you know, I would sit there and stare at her with cow eyes. And then finally she'd say, Maureen, it's okay. You can go home now. And I'd say, okay. And I tell her I love her and I would leave. Well, this day wasn't like that. They had taken her back to the hospital. She had pneumonia from the chemotherapy. The hospital said, Maureen, have you ever put anybody on life support before? I said, no. Can I call you back? That's how I was back then. If I made all of your problems about me, here she was getting ready to leave the world. And the best I could come up with is, I need a drink. Can I call you back? And I went down to the bar and I started drinking. And at 5:30 in the afternoon, the guy I was with at the time pulled me off the bar stool and said, you better get down to Downey or your mom's going to be dead. And I took the bus down to Downey, which is like 25 miles away. And I went into the emergency room in Downey Community Hospital. And there was my sister and my dad. And they were both crying. And my dad says, you're not going to make it. Or your mom's not going to make it. And my sister is disgusted, just beyond disgusted. She's got 2 years sober at this time. She's in AA and she is flabbergasted that I would show up to the ER drunk. And she looks at my dad and she goes, she's drunk. And my dad goes, it's okay. Your mother would have been too. And he's crying. I'll never forget that. And I went in and I squeezed my mother's hand and I told her I loved her and I left. And a half an hour later, she was gone. And I spent the next couple years drinking and complaining about my unresolved relationship with her to anybody who would listen, sit next to me in a bar, buy me a drink, whatever. It was painful. I wasn't going to get over it. And, you know, I was 26 when this happened. I thought that was way too young to lose a parent. And I just didn't understand why all of this was happening to me. And what happened was I kept drinking and I just got worse and worse. And finally, the day before my 28th birthday, my boss called me and he said, if you're late for work one more time, I'm going to fire you. And I didn't think he would really fire me because I had done things like drank beer out of a tumbler on my desk. I mean, I literally, back in those days, because it was a long time ago, it was like in the 80s, everybody drank all the time. They drank at lunchtime. They did drugs. They, like, it was havoc in the entertainment industry. And I didn't think he'd really do it. So I had already, you know, I was like, okay, I'll try to take some precautions. I'll have two drinks because then by then I'm addicted and I have to have it. That was always, I'll have two drinks. I never had two drinks in my life. That was just complete delusion. And I went to the bar after work and I had two drinks. And by 2 o'clock in the morning, when the bartender was locking the door and, we were all still in there drinking, I realized I just didn't need that job anymore anyway. And I just didn't care about it anymore. And I went on a 3-day run. And at the end of 3 days, I called up my boss and I was arrogant enough that I said, so am I fired? 3-day no call, no show. And I have the nerve to ask if I'm fired. And I'll never forget this. He says, well, yes, but we're leaving you on the health insurance for a while because we think you're going to need it. And they were trying to push me into rehab too, apparently. And somebody else in the company hired me during that period. And he called him up and said, if she's not working for me, she's not working for anybody here. Get her out of here today. And I literally have had to go back in AA and make amends to that man. And today we're friends and we've been friends for a long time. And he wants the best for me. And he's, you know, when I got sober, I knew I owed him an amends. And I went in and he didn't have anybody in my old spot. And I went in and cleaned the desk up for him for free. I didn't ask for any payment for it. I told him, look, this is not even enough in comparison with what I did. But, you know, I'm telling you, this is the best I can do right now. And I'm sorry. I wouldn't have done it if I wasn't sick. And he understands that and we're cool now. And, you know, what happened is at toward the end of that unemployment period. So now I'm unemployed up in Hollywood and I'm basically drinking 24/7. And finally, you know, by then my mom had died. And let me just say my drinking was so bad at this time. My mom and my grandmothers all died within a couple of months of each other. And my mom and my mother's mother died in the same week. And, you know, what was my response to that? Just continue drinking and make life living hell for my family. That's what I did. When my first grandmother died, I'll never forget this. I stole pills out of my mother's medicine chest because I just needed to be medicated with something. And it was accidentally her chemotherapy medication. And I'll never forget this because it was at a Catholic church with a, you know, with nuns. And I, you know, I was so bad. I, you know, went into the bathroom in there and I tried to make myself throw up. And all of a sudden I turn around and there's a nun staring at me, watching me do this. Again, pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So, you know, all of this happened and I called up my dad and I said, if I stay up here, I'm going to be dead. And, you know, one of the thoughts about that came fairly recently because I, you know, on Halloween was when my first grandmother died and it was my dad's mom. And I called him and told him that my apartment had gotten broken into the night before, which was true, while I was in it. And I was again in a blackout and whoever broke in and stole everything I had went out the front door. Oh my goodness. I think we just either had an earthquake or a wind tunnel thing. Stole all my money, went out the front door, and the managers the next day said that they expected to find a corpse in there. And who do I call? My father, who just lost his mother. Like, if you would have asked me, I loved all these people. But at the end, I couldn't love them more than I loved myself. I just couldn't, I was incapable of forming true partnerships with other human beings. And I called him up and I said, look, I have to get out of here. And he said, okay. And he and my brothers came up and moved my stuff and they weren't happy about it. And that night when I was sitting in my father's house, I hear my brother talking to him and my brother says, what are you going to do with her? And my dad goes, I would sell this house. I would give her every cent I have. I would do whatever it took if I just thought she would quit drinking. But I don't think she's going to quit. And I don't think there's any help for her. And I'm sitting in the other room going, yeah, I have a tendency to agree. And the next day I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous and found my way back. And I didn't get sober right away. But the thing I want to tell you that's so important about my dad doing that is I did move back in with my dad. And at some point, my dad and I switched roles because my dad got cancer too. And I took care of my dad before he died. And a couple of days before he died, he said to me, I think I'm dying and they're not telling me. And I said, well, would it change anything if you were? Would you want to know? And he goes, well, what if I had unfinished business with someone? And he said, and I said, do you have unfinished business with me? And he said, no. And then he said, I don't think you're ever going to drink again. So thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous, we went all the way from you are beyond hope to I never think you're going to drink again. And when my dad left this world, he was absolutely certain that I was in the good hands of Alcoholics Anonymous and my higher power. And for that, there is nothing that I can ever do that can pay that back. I feel the responsibility of getting my life back here because I could have easily been dead. Now, the part that I've missed on this is there came a point right before all that happened where my sister and I both got breast cancer at the same time. So it turned out my mom was prophetic when she talked to me about going into denial about it because I was in my 30s when this happened and I wasn't expecting it. And there was a point where, you know, with my drinking, I had a busted out back window. It was going to cost $89 to fix it. And I wouldn't spend $89 on fixing my car window because you can buy a lot of vodka with $89. And it was just going to affect my alcohol tab way too much. And here I am in my 30s. Knowing that I need to go get checked for this because I obviously there's something wrong in my family. It's now my sister and my mom have had it. And I come to find out that I have a gene mutation that because of you people, I could afford the testing to go do self-care to get the test required to take care of myself. Alcoholics Anonymous didn't just save my life once. I had no money for anything other than alcohol and I've had to invest the money in making sure that, you know, I was going to be okay. And it was caught early. I had to have treatment for it, but I'm still alive and it was a long, long time ago. And that's happened 4 times since I've been sober. And every time the other times that it happened, it was caught even earlier than the first time. And I'm still around to sponsor people and be of service and to carry the message that if you have an unmanageable life, it doesn't have to stay that way if you're in the arms of higher power. And that's been my experience. What happened after that, you know, eventually my dad did pass away and, you know, I was a little lost for a minute because I don't know any of you that have been caregivers to somebody that's sick. You kind of don't know what you're going to do after that. You're kind of thrown for a loop. The thing was, the night that he passed away, I was at an AA meeting surrounded by active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I had wanted to drink, they weren't going to leave me alone long enough. And I respect that. And I've tried to do it for other people. And I got through it. And what happened after that is my program actually took off. By then I had some years sober. And we had started a home group, and that home group, you know, I was a person that when I was new, I sat in the back of the room and I thought you should have my coffee and my chair ready for me. And that, you know, I was busier than you. So thank you very much. I really appreciated your service, but I didn't have to do anything myself. That is not my story today. I'm very active. And, you know, what happened after that is in my home group, you know, there was some people. I didn't get sober right away. I had a hard time because I was physically addicted. And there were people in AA that watched my seat and made sure that people left me alone so that I could find my way to sobriety. And I try to be that person in my home group now. If there's a tough case, I'm on it. And I don't even feel bad about it because I know that there were people that were there for me. And what happened was I moved back in with my dad and I didn't get sober right away. But after doing this gigantic geographic move, I ended up getting drunk a couple of blocks away from my dad's house and in a bar with somebody that I went to high school with. She was a bartender. And the next day, there was my dad again, standing at the bed with his slippers in the same robe. And he goes, "You got to go." And I felt like something had lifted. He had gone out with the police that morning to find what I hit because I no longer had a car. The night before, my car died in the middle of an intersection. I got out of the car. I dragged myself up Wiley Burke Avenue on my knees with the neighbors looking out the doors going, "Look at her. She's disgusting." Another thing that I learned after I got sober this time, if you're new, if you're starting to lose your motor skills, that is advancing alcoholism. And that's where I was at. I couldn't quit. And that morning, my family was doing a family pool, taking bets about what I was going to happen with the job I got 6 months before that, after the only unemployment I had ever had in my whole life. They were absolutely certain I was going to have to quit that job. But I didn't, because I'd been around AA long enough that a power greater than myself was there. And I got on the bus and took the bus from one side of LA to the other to go to work. And after 30 days, the head mechanic at work sold me a great car for $500. And that problem was solved. And because I had a higher power, I realized that, you know, God was rewarding my footwork. You know, I heard somebody say in a meeting that sometimes we overuse the word God. And, you know, for me, that's just easiest. It's one symbol. It's one syllable. And it just is. That's what I call my higher power. You can call yours whatever you like. And as long as you have one, it's not you. And I did. And what happened is I started to put some days together. And that was after the last time I drank. And, you know, after my dad died, you know, my whole life started to change. That job that I was on, that I was still on because I did what you people taught me to do. I talked about being a flake on my former job. I showed up if I was dying to this job. And like the former person that nobody could depend on became somebody that everybody depended on. Thanks to AA. My fundamental way I presented myself in the world changed. And if it can change for somebody that was as screwed up as I was, it can change for you too. And what happened is I got full tilt into the AA program as it's laid out. We were lucky enough to have a lot of literature laid out for us. Not just the big book in the 12 and 12, but the IPs, the service manual, all the stuff that was laid out for us. It's just a roadmap to a happy life. And I started to get into it about the time that our home group started. And I got, you know, I started to sponsor people. There's somebody in this meeting right now that when she asked me to sponsor, I told her no, because I honestly believe that I had nothing anybody wanted. And what I know today is it isn't about me anyway. if you're wondering if you have anything to give away to anybody, honestly, your higher power will give you what you need to pass along. This isn't something that you have to know and have to be profoundly good at the gate. You learn and you give them what you've got. And in my experience, in most cases, that's been enough. And, you know, I've managed to, you know, I got into the big book and all of that stuff. I've been lucky to have people helping us that really knew the big book. And, you know, things changed my life, like that this was our course paragraph in the big book. I didn't really realize that if you put yourself in somebody else's shoes, you could pretty much get over anything within reason, of course. And I, you know, some of that stuff that I learned were just tools for living that I still use today. And every time I pass it along, I learn more. Every time, sometimes the people that I sponsor will come back and it, you know, it's not just about people with time. Sometimes we learn the most from people that don't have as much time. You know, I've been very active, during the pandemic, and I have a sponsee that I've taken almost all the way through the steps in Maryland, and I'm in California. And she told me one day we were going through, the doctor's opinion. And she goes, if I'm reading this correctly, then what this is saying is that God can help me with anything, not just drugs and alcohol. And then I just have to not say, well, I'm just like that, so I can't change. So it's pretty much any character defect you have can be lifted. And I'm hearing this from somebody with 2 weeks sober. And she's looking at me on the Zoom camera. And I'm like, thanks. I don't know if that helped you, but I needed to hear it. Because sometimes with a lot of time, we forget that anything that we're carrying around can be lifted. All we have to do is want it to be lifted and do what it takes to lift it. And she gave me that message again right now during the pandemic. And, you know, our home group means a lot to me. I've seen them be very adaptive during the Zoom period, as I can tell that yours is. And, you know, I'm proud of them for that. And I'm proud of you for that. To me, we're great examples of, you know, seeing what the opportunities are and jumping on it to try to go help new people. And I realize that that is my purpose. You know, I'm going through a thing right now where I'm furloughed off my job, and the job that I had all those years ago when I got sober, I'm still on it, and I'm furloughed right now, and I don't know if I'm going back. And that would seem like a mind blower, except I don't define myself by my job anymore. I define myself by my primary purpose, which is helping the alcoholic who still suffers. And when I remember that, and I remember that God is my real employer anyway, that's a key to getting through this horrible time. Like I try to remember, if it wasn't for God, I wouldn't have found my way back there to begin with. I wouldn't have been able to stay on the job. Like life has completely, completely changed. Around the time, gosh, I'm trying to think about how many years ago it was, but I had this friend and he was my role model because he was very into the fact that he was a janitor and he had just gotten a new mop bucket at his job. And he was so proud of that mop bucket and he was so proud of the job that he was doing at his work. And I started to realize, you know, how important everybody's job is. And that I watched that person stay sober and do what it took and throw himself into the middle of AA. And I started to, it was a monkey see, monkey do situation with he and I. And we were not together for a year. And at the end of a year, after we were best friends for a year, he asked me to go on a date with him. And I said, are you crazy? Like, why would you want to date me? And he said that he thought we should do that. Well, last July, we got married after being together for 25 years. And I was a person that when I got here, my last relationship was not even a relationship. You know, I can't even explain how bad it was, but when you're only around people who are as screwed up as you are, water is going to rise to its own level. And I had to find that out the hard way. And I haven't had to be that way for a long time. You know, I started a women's meeting about 17 years ago. And the reason I started it, interestingly enough, Bob D was a big, he was the one who actually suggested that I start it, because the women that I sponsored wanted to kill each other. And he told me that they had a traditions problem, and that it, he said 1, 5, and 12. So I got off the phone with them. I got my 12 and 12 and I read it. Sure enough, they did. I had a birthday party. They threw a birthday party for me, and one of them sucker punched another one in the face in the middle of my birthday party. Can you imagine that? And what happened was, the night I started this meeting, per Bob's instructions, 5 people fired me. They got up in a little line into my face and said, not coming back, not coming back, one after the other after the other. But the ones that were left, there, many of them I still sponsor today. And our group studies the traditions, not just the steps, half the year. And since then, there's been people that say, we just don't understand why there's no backbiting in your group. And I laugh. I'm like, there's backbiting. They just know not to say it out loud. And because we study the traditions here, and we understand that the unity of the group is the most important thing. And, you know, it was something that I didn't always know. You know, when I was first starting to sponsor people, there was a woman who I had just done a 4-step with, and I told her I didn't think she was going to enough meetings. And she said, okay, whatever. And then she proceeded to tell, like, everybody down at our local Olano club that I put her 5-step in the street, that I had discussed specifics of her 5-step, which anybody who knows me for 5 minutes knows I would never do that. Like, that's not, it was something I would never, ever do. And I didn't have a lot of experience at the time, and I cried for 4 days. It hurt my feelings so bad, I just couldn't get over it. Well, fast forward like 6 months, she shows up down at the club. She goes, can I talk to you for a minute? And I said, yeah, but I'll be right back. I did that, the whole thing with her too. And I went out to the parking lot and I called Bob, and I'm like, do I have to help this woman? Like, she's horrible. Do I have to help her? And I'll never forget this. He said, you know, he brought me back to the first tradition. And he said that my personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And I was like, what? I just told you she's horrible. He goes, what that means is, if you don't have unity with the people in the group, you're going to get drunk. Oh, well, that I understood, because I didn't want to get drunk again. And that's when my relationship with the traditions began. I realized that I needed to pay just as much attention to the traditions as I did the steps. And, you know, although I had gotten, you know, had done the work for me personally, I needed to know how to get along with others when these things happen. And he goes, now you turn around, you go back in there and you tell her you love her and that you'll do whatever you can to help her. And I turned around and went back in and I told her I loved her and I would do whatever I can to help her. And you know what? She's still my friend today too. That whole thing is just mended. It hasn't been brought up in years and years and years. The amends process is a huge thing. I learned a long time ago that prompt amends are a gift from God, and that I don't like laying in bed at night fuming, thinking about how the other person was wrong and I'm right. I don't do that anymore. I just try to put myself in their shoes and move on. And it's not always easy to do that, but for me, that's just easier. You know, I told you that, you know, I was talking about my mom and about how, you know, what it was like when I didn't go to the hospital. Well, obviously my dad, it was not that same story. But after that, after all these fears about being around sick people and dying people and all that, you know, when the book talks about you being able to handle things that used to baffle you, I had a sponsee call me one day and said, I have a couple of months to live and I want you to be my power of attorney. And I was like, okay, what about your kids? Well, no, I want you to do it. Okay. And I helped this woman leave the world. And she had enough faith in me that she knew that I would do what I said I was going to do. That is a miracle from where I come from. And what happened after that is, you know, I now am a person that people call when something like that happens. Last week, my sister, who's got, you know, 34 years on the program, she was supposed to have surgery, and her husband, who was supposed to drive her to the surgery, had a heart attack like 2 days before he was supposed to drive her, ended up in the hospital with a heart attack and kidney cancer and a cancer tumor in his heart. And he was sicker than she was. So I went up there and helped them. And, you know, when I got sober, she was sending me I got sober in August and my birthday is in March. And she sent me a big balloon bouquet. And she told me later that it was her Al-Anon sponsor told her to send it because she was writing me off because I was such a flake. She just couldn't stand it anymore. And she, you know, I realized that I'm going to probably have to go up there again to help them. And I've turned into somebody that is stable in other people's lives. And I'm grateful for that because, you know, I never did want to be that person. And I never, if you would have told me I was going to get addicted to alcohol, I never liked it enough, just the taste of it enough to even want to do that. I don't think I would have signed up for it if I would have known what would happen. But what happened this time, I read a book that had nothing to do with AA, right around the time I got sober. And I came to find out that I was late middle stage alcoholism when I quit, and that if I kept it up, I identified that. I put myself on the scale, and if I kept it up, I was going to end up a certifiable wet brain alcoholic. And I haven't had to do that. What happened is after I quit drinking, the other thing is I went back to school. I was somebody's assistant for a billion years, and it was clear that that was getting to be obsolete. And I changed careers. So I even finished what I started there. And, you know, I'm taking other stuff that pertains to my degree right now. And I'm trying to get another degree because I'm a technologist. So it matters. But, you know, AA gave me the backbone to not be afraid to start things that I wasn't sure I was going to be able to finish. And I've been able to be there for a lot of other people. A couple of years ago, I married two of my sponsees. They asked me to perform the ceremony. And I thought, they don't know this, but how do you get from passing out in an alley in a burned out refrigerator, which is what I did, to two people, meaning enough to two people that they want you to marry them and be in their wedding pictures? Alcoholics Anonymous did that. That blows me away. My gratitude for this program is just unending. And you know what? I know that it's a tough time right now for a lot of people. I sat through, I'm doing some volunteer work now for an outside organization. And I sat through a talk from a doctor at USC about COVID. And she was talking about trauma. And she was calling it chronic trauma right now because this thing just isn't vanishing like we would want it to. And she was talking about that they've done studies about road rage going up, domestic violence going up. People are just restless, irritable, and discontent. And I feel it in myself. But what she was saying is it's across the board. It's everybody. But the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous is, I don't know about you, but when I get like this, I know what to do now. I've been sober for 32 years. And if I don't know what to do, there's no excuse. And one of the biggest keys for me staying here long term, the thing that scares me to death is that I see people with decades sober all of a sudden just decide they just don't want to do this thing anymore. And I don't want that to be me because, you know, when I think about it, I almost didn't get this. It took me a year and a half to get a 30-day chip. And I was, you know, sober for parts of it. One time I was speaking and somebody goes, oh, you have such a message for people that relapse. And I'm like, relapse? I didn't relapse because I never was sober long enough that I thought it was a real relapse. I didn't think going to meetings meant I was sober. I wasn't even sober, right? And you know, I haven't had to be like that in a long time. You know, my interest in alcohol really had left me at an early stage. When I got a 30-day chip finally, I thought to myself, I don't want to ever go through this again. This was hell. And I knew that jails, institutions, and death were what was waiting for me. That car that they left in the middle of the, it got left in the middle of the intersection. They found what I hid. It was a parking post that I drive by every August 14th. That parking post doesn't mean anything to anybody, but that morning I didn't know what I hid. I didn't know that it wasn't a person. I went to jail twice behind my drinking. I went once when I was 21 and then 3 months later. And I got away till I was 31 when I quit drinking. And, you know, I got away for a lot of years doing a lot of shenanigans and really pressed it right up to the line. And you know what? I'm glad that I survived it. But I also know that the reason why I survived it is because there's going to be people put on my path and I at least have to give them a shot. One of the coolest things that's happened to me recently is I started sponsoring this girl who is in a facility in Arizona, and I can't really sponsor her appropriately right now, but she logs into our meeting every Sunday and she just had a baby. And you know, I watched her last Sunday. One of the things I'm learning about having time in the program is I don't have to always be the person talking. Sometimes I can just be that person that stands back and watches two other people that have less time making that connection. And it's just magic when it happens. And here is this girl, she's talking to this girl who I don't think we're ever going to see again. At the end of the night, she said to me, I just think that I'm going to continue to drink. I'm just not going to drive. I said, well, let us know how that works out for you. And, but this girl, she says, I called you and asked you to sponsor me because of your track record. You have a lot of girls that have a lot of time sober. And I do. But I don't think that's me. I think that's our connection with a higher power going on right there. And I was so grateful because if that's what our group represents and that if that's what our group is projecting, that's a flipping miracle. And I'm looking at somebody right now in my group and I'm just so grateful for that. You know, during that period where I was such a mess, I went into a coffee shop and I was drunk again and I had 4 days sober before I went in. And you know, these guys that reached out to me, it was perfectly innocent. One of them looked like Alfred Hitchcock and the other one, like it was the craziest looking guys and they used to like protect me. And he says, well, we know why you're drunk again. And I said, why is that? They go, you're an alcoholic. That's what we do. And I said, okay, but, and what's the and part? And they go ahead and go home and sleep it off and come back to AA tomorrow. And he goes, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. And that was the third, that was the third tradition. That was my first exposure to the third tradition. And when he said that to me, I felt like a huge weight had been lifted off me because I felt like such a freak everywhere I went. And he was telling me, hey, it's okay to come back tomorrow. We know where you're at. And if I could do nothing for the rest of my life, but be that person who keeps that door open, I'm okay with that. So if you're new, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. You landed in a great group. And, you know, I'm really pleased to be here and thank you all for listening.